This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
In a populated suburb of St. Louis, Missouri, nuclear waste from American bomb-making is washing into surface water. Now all that radioactive mess is threatened by an underground fire just 1,200 feet away. If that's the best the United States can do after all these years, what chance does Australia have with their grand plans to make South Australia a dumping ground for the world's nuclear waste? It's time for another round of nuclear madness, and the doctor is in. It's Dr. Helen Caldicott, the most famous anti-nuclear campaigner in the world. Helen, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Let's start with your own country, Australia. Who in their right minds would volunteer to accept nuclear waste from around the world right into beautiful South Australia?
Well, okay, that's a good question, and they're not in their right minds. They are suffering an acute attack of nuclear madness, in fact. It's interesting because the whole anti-nuclear movement in Australia started in 71, actually in my sitting room, when we got a high fallout from French tests in the Pacific. And I wrote a letter to the paper and then was on television talking about the fact children could get leukemia, etc., from the French tests. And because the Australians really don't like the French, they think they're arrogant, in 9 months, 75% of Australians spontaneously rose up, marches in city streets, etc., and the Prime Minister was forced to take France to the International Court of Justice, where she was then forced to test underground. And that was spontaneous, really, through education. And then several years later, I found out that the Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam, wanted to mine and export uranium, knowing nothing about nuclear power. I went to the university library and got a book called Poison Power by Goffman and Tamplin, Goffman being a physician and a physicist. And I was absolutely shocked. So I got around and spoke to most of the unions in Australia. At that time, the workforce was heavily unionized about the medical aspects of mining uranium, both to them, their families, and the world. And then, so the Council of Trade Unions, Australian Council of Trade Unions, then banned uranium mining for 5 years and export. So at that time in the 70s and 80s, Australians were extremely well informed about plutonium. We had bumper stickers which said plutonium is thalidomide forever because it enters the placenta and damages the fetus the way thalidomide did. But, you know, generations change, people change, the media changes, and if you don't keep educating people and you don't have the expertise present in the media to educate people, people think everything's okay. So into this vacuum, if you will, nuclear vacuum, moved the South Australian government because the federal government cancelled car companies in South Australia, so there is a lot of unemployment. Now, there are a lot of pro-nuclear people who've converged upon South Australia, including from the London School of Economics, and they have been pushing for Adelaide to build nuclear submarines, to build small modular reactors, to have the whole fuel cycle from uranium mining right through to waste disposal, and above and beyond everything, to store the world's radioactive waste in South Australia, the notion being that South Australia would earn so much money from grateful countries that people would not have to pay taxes nor electricity bills in South Australia, and it would be all just very good. There's been a royal commission which is totally stacked with pro-nuclear people. I testified there and the lawyer was very aggressive. It was like an inquisition, really. And most people who've testified are pro-nuclear. So the thing's out of hand. The Australian Broadcasting Commission, like your CBC, has been surprisingly docile about this. And the main newspaper in South Australia is Murdoch's paper, the advertiser. He owns 75% of the printed press in Australia. So things are grim. I think, though, when the report comes out on February the 15th, advising that radioactive waste should be stored in South Australia, the proverbial SHIT will hit the fan, and people will be extremely upset. I'll be speaking at a public meeting the night after that announcement is made. The person who is the commissioner of the Royal Commission is a man called Kevin Scarce. I like that name, scarcely knowledgeable. And he's an army man, no scientific background at all. And he's the one to make the decision. So things are really grim, and it just shows when you have an uneducated, docile public what people can do in the name of what I would call evil, because nuclear power plants are cancer factories, and they make waste that lasts for a million years and will inevitably leak and get into people's bodies and the food chain, et cetera, et cetera. And also they're bomb factories, because any reactor makes plutonium and you need 5 kilos to make a bomb. So things are very grim here. And, you know, Cameco's got its fingers in the pie as well. Cameco is really bad from your country. And Canada hasn't a moral leg to stand on, because she's one of the main exporters of uranium. And, in fact, the first two atomic bombs used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were manufactured from Canadian uranium.
But just a minute now, Helen. I mean, South Australia is a major uranium producer. Isn't it fair that then that region should take back the radioactive byproducts that it's shipping out to other countries?
Well, we're talking about the world's radioactive products, and I think there are 255,000 tons of high-level waste, I think, in the world now that's accrued. So you could say the same thing for Canada. Why don't you take the waste back from all the uranium you've exported to be used in your CANDU reactors around the world?
No way.
There you go. So you asked a good devil's advocate question, but the truth is that the storage of radioactive waste has never been worked out. And, you know, I've been saying how long have I been doing this? 44 years? What about radioactive waste? And they say, trust us, we're scientists, we're good scientists, we'll find the cure to the storage of radioactive waste. And I say, well, that's like me saying to a patient, look, you've got pancreatic carcinoma, your prognosis is 6 months, but trust me, I'm a very good doctor and scientist. In 20 years' time, I'll find the cure. In fact, so ludicrous is this situation that in America there's a statute called the Waste Confidence Bill. They have confidence, the nuclear industry, that they will work out what to do with radioactive waste over a million years. So the whole thing is, well, it's psychotic. There's a split between reality and perception of reality.
How do we know that South Australia is being considered for foreign waste and not just medical waste generated in Australia?
Well, it's very interesting, Alex. There are two situations occurring. One is we've got a small reactor at a place called Lucas Heights, surrounded by, I think, 13 schools and kindergartens in the suburb of Sydney. And that has been going for a long time. It was set up originally so that Australia could make its own bomb. America stepped in, however, and said, no, you're not allowed to have a bomb. And the excuse has always been that, you know, we use Lucas Heights, a small reactor, to make radioactive isotopes for medicine. The truth is that for many years we've been able to make all the isotopes we need in medicine from a cyclotron, which makes no radioactive waste. Now, the Lucas Heights has generated quite a lot of high-level waste, and so what it did was send it to France to be reprocessed. In other words, out of sight is out of mind, but the agreement was that when it's reprocessed, which means chopping the incredibly radioactive fuel rods into small pieces, dissolving them in concentrated nitric acid, and from that witch's corrosive radioactive brew is precipitated out plutonium, which has only one use, really, and that's for bombs. Why we wanted that, I don't know. So now France did that, and then I think they vitrified the liquid waste, I think, into glass, which doesn't really work anyway. And the agreement was it would be returned. Now, the Commonwealth government is in charge of that process, and it's an entirely different process from the Royal Commission taking place in South Australia, where they want to import the world's radioactive waste. And apparently the Commonwealth government is extremely annoyed with this South Australian Royal Commission. I mean, they're at odds with each other. Now, what they've proposed, the Commonwealth government, is 5 or 6 sites in Australia out of the way, out of sight, out of mind, to store this waste. Well, they announced these sites some months ago, and, of course, the local communities are up in arms, very annoyed, and, in fact, one of them has asked me to go out and talk about it. What they propose to do is virtually just build a shed and put this waste in a shed and then forget about it. What they've done now in the interim is build a shed at Lucas Heights and put it at Lucas Heights. So that's a different contingency compared to the South Australian Royal Commission and their objective.
What about dumps on lands claimed by the Aboriginal people? What are the original owners of the land saying, and are Aboriginal people represented on this Royal Commission in South Australia?
No, they're not, because to put in a submission, you had to get it signed by a JP, a Justice of Peace. You know, those people out on their own country, they don't have JPs. And so the whole thing was mitigated against any Aboriginal people putting in submissions. However, a few submissions have gone in the name of the Aboriginal people. The truth is, you know, this land belongs to them, all of it. We stole it, like you did in Canada, from the original Indigenous people. There are land rights, but governments, in fact, have been able to say, well, you know, in this area where there's uranium, you can't have any land rights. That's what they do in past laws. I mean, Caucasians, in one sense, I believe, are very wicked. They don't care about Indigenous people who know how to care for the land and the world. But the Aborigines can muster a fairly large contingent of people, and they do have impact on the public consciousness when they go to Parliament and testify. I'm not sure what our new Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, will do about it. He's made no comment, but his wife, Lucy Turnbull, who's a very intelligent woman, came to one of my talks a few years ago with her daughter, Daisy, and I thought, oh boy, this is good. I can teach them, and, you know, they can then talk to Malcolm. However, at the end of my talk, they left and didn't stay for questions, and I thought, oh, I don't think they got the message, or that they didn't want to get the message. So I'm not sure where the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, stands on all of this.
In the new carbon-charged world, you are listening to Radio EcoShock, broadcast around the world on radio and the Internet. Find Radio EcoShock on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, the weekly show blog at ecoshock.info, at archive.org, and our website, ecoshock.org. Tune in. Turn on. All right. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is the world-renowned anti-nuclear campaigner, Dr. Helen Caldicott. I'd say you are from Australia, Helen, but you did spend many years in the United States, and there you reinvigorated a doctor's movement as well, didn't you?
Yes, I spent 20 years in Boston, and I was at Harvard on the faculty working there, and I was asked by the editor of the New England Journal, Inglefinger, to write an article on the medical dangers of nuclear power. So I spent a year off and on in the Countway Library at Harvard researching the literature. This was 78. I wrote the article, so I learned an awful lot, mostly from the Nuclear Power Industry, Journal of Health Physics. And it was rejected by peer review because they said, well, you haven't said anything good about nuclear power. And I said, look, there's nothing good medically about nuclear power. It's like saying if you have a factory full of polio virus and by replicating it produce heat and electricity, that's good. So it was rejected. However, during the time I was writing and researching for that article, a young physician visited me, and I turned to him and I said, you know, Ira, this is a medical issue. Let's start a medical organization. And it happened that there was an old medical organization which was now defunct in Boston called Physicians for Social Responsibility, but still was registered in the state of Massachusetts. So we used the name, but there were no members. And we put an ad in the New England Journal of Medicine about the dangers of nuclear power, and serendipitously it came out the day after Three Mile Island melted down. And suddenly we were besieged by members. And after that, we started doing a symposia on the medical effects of nuclear war. And the journalists were stunned. They said, well, what are doctors talking about nuclear war for? This is a political issue. And we said, no, it's a medical issue, because nuclear war will cause the final epidemic of the human race. And so we were besieged by money from foundations, and we really prospered. In time, we had 153 chapters and 23,000 members. we were all over television, radio, writing op-ed pieces, and in fact we led the movement in America and indeed throughout the world, because I travelled everywhere to Canada and all over the world starting similar medical organisations. The only place I couldn't get in was Russia, but then they joined as well. And so in 5 years, from 78, where most Americans said to me, well, I'd rather be dead than red, in other words, die in a nuclear war than be a communist, they realised that it was better to be alive and not have a nuclear war. 80% of Americans in 5 years became opposed to nuclear weapons and war. So that was, I consider, the second American Revolution, peaceful, sagacious and Gandhian. And then many other organisations started, like Architects for Social Responsibility, because they said nuclear war would destroy architecture. You know, historians, even morticians became opposed because they didn't want to work with radioactive bodies. And I said, well, don't worry, you'll be one yourself. But anyway, they passed the resolution against nuclear war. So it was a really exciting time, and we got 1 million people in Central Park, the largest rally ever in the history of America. And Canada was all alight and afire, and that movement globally led to the end of the Cold War. I met with Reagan in his office for an hour and a half, hour and a quarter, and talked to him about nuclear war and all the technology, etc. He knew very little, but he did then afterwards start working with Gorbachev, and he started to say nuclear war must never be fought and can never be won. So that was an amazing thing, but what happened was when the Berlin Wall came down, and Gorbachev allowed it to happen, people thought, thank God that's over. And we all fell on our couches almost unconscious. We were so tired and thought things would be fixed. And they started talking about peace dividend. They wouldn't have to spend money on weapons anymore. But never underestimate the power of the military-industrial complex, as President Eisenhower once warned us. And they mobilised themselves because without war they can't make their weapons and they can't steal America's taxpayers' money. And gradually people forgot, the media dropped it, we were not on television anymore, we seemed irrelevant. And here we are now with, I think, facing the greatest danger, or a greater danger, since the height of the Cold War.
And all that radiation from developing the bombs, quite a bit of it ended up, it turns out, near St. Louis, Missouri, right in the middle of America. You'll be heading there. Why are you going to St. Louis?
Well, during the Manhattan Project, a lot of the uranium came actually from, it was an African country, Zambia, I think, and it was very concentrated. Mostly uranium, when it's mined, it only has 0.7% uranium-235. And that's so for your Canadian uranium-2, and 235 is the one that fissions. And you have to enrich it to 3% for nuclear power and over 50% for bombs. So it was very concentrated, and it also was, of course, Canadian uranium. There was a company called Mallinckrodt, and they were enriching the uranium and working with it to make the first bombs for the Manhattan Project. And there was a huge amount of waste, and very highly radioactive. And they just dumped it on the ground near the airport and in various locations around that area. And no one really ever took responsibility for it. And it's lying in huge piles near the Coldwater Creek. And what has happened, of course, is that communities have built houses right up to the waste. And serendipitously, or that's the wrong word, there's a rubbish dump, rubbish tip, we call it in Australia, just very close to the radioactive dump. And a spontaneous fire has been burning in that underground for a long time, and it's approaching the radioactive waste dump. Meanwhile, recently a lot of tests have been performed to show that radium, which is a daughter of uranium, radium-226, which gave Madame Curie leukemia or aplastic anemia, and her daughter died of leukemia, very, very toxic. That's been found in vegetation, in the water, around, in people's gardens and the like. And other daughters like radon gas which is a very carcinogenic gas and is a major cause of lung cancer in the world today, that's been seeping out of the dumps, etc. And there are quite a lot of daughters of uranium that are polluting the area. There's a high incidence of cancers, one of which is cancer of the appendix. Now, look, that is as rare as hen's teeth, as we say in Australia, because hens don't have teeth. You call them chickens, we call them chooks. Anyway, rare as hen's teeth, appendiceal cancer, I think there are 23 cases. I don't know why the uranium or one of its daughters would lodge in the appendix. And also there's quite a high incidence of leukemia, of brain cancers, et cetera, et cetera. So the people have been impacted by this since 1945. So they're victims of the Cold War. And they've just been left really to rot in place. And the Environmental Protection Agency has taken no responsibility, nor has the federal government. And, of course, what they did was they sold it off to private companies, for heaven's sake. And the private companies, of course, they don't know what to do with it, and they don't, you know, they want to make profit, so they don't care. So things are very grim. So I'm going to address a symposium orchestrated by the local community college and do quite a lot of media talking about how radiation and these radioactive elements cause cancer and what should be done. Of course, the whole community should be evacuated, like they should be evacuated from your town in Port Hope in Canada, which is built on radioactive tailings.
Yes, indeed. And it isn't just the fire risk. Anybody watching the evening news has seen video of the extreme rainfall events that have hit the St. Louis area this winter, with floods reaching down much of the Mississippi River. I've seen photos of rainwater washing out of that nuke dump we're talking about at the Westlake landfill into local ditches and streams. It's a big concern, really.
I don't know what they, I mean, let's be pragmatic. What should they do with it? Well, I suppose they need to ship it somewhere out in the desert, dig huge holes and put it back in the ground from whence it came, because all the uranium has been mined from underneath the ground, and it's safer it's quite safe in the ground. And that's what should happen. Of course, it'll cost a lot of money, but America's, you know, they spend over $1 trillion a year on weapons and killing and death in the Pentagon. So the money's there. It just has to be reallocated for the health and well-being of the American people, not for death and destruction and the end of the earth.
Well, meanwhile, the Environmental Protection Agency is proposing to build some kind of wall between the landfill site where the fire is and the nuclear dumping site. What do you think of that?
Oh, it won't happen in time, A. B, I don't know if that will make any difference. C, why don't they remove the stuff? D, why don't they dig a hole in the waste, in the rubbish dump and put the fire out, and simultaneously moving the radioactive waste from that area and taking it somewhere where it can be put back in the ground safely? So it's like building an ice wall around Fukushima to stop the water flowing into the ocean. It's a notion that is baseless in science.
And, you know, just as you say, we picture a nuclear waste site as high tech, but I've seen actual photos of this Westlake landfill in Missouri, and it's just a pile of dirt with no containment other than it's just got plastic tarps on top. Are the plans any better for what they want to do in Australia?
They haven't announced what their plans are. Anyway, you know, there's nowhere in the world that they've developed a system or a facility to store radioactive safely for the next million years, according to the Environmental Protection Agency in America. There's nowhere.
Yeah, it's true. You know, the United States has had 60 years to deal with the nuclear materials from the Manhattan Bomb Project. And, you know, at the Hanford Nuclear Reserve in Washington State, that's just south of me, there's giant piles, as you know, of super radioactive materials just sitting in rotting concrete tubs, and every now and then they talk about them exploding. It's never been properly handled by anyone in the history of the nuclear age.
No, Hanford's just it's like hell. And I know the incidence of anencephalic babies is quite high in that area, babies born with no brains and other severe congenital anomalies. So it's just an absolute disaster. And what staggers me is that the industry keeps making more and more and more and more of the stuff with nowhere to put it. And they know that. They know that. So, you know, these people, I think, are criminals and should be jailed because they're long-term murderers. I mean, how much does it, what would you pay a woman who's given birth to a baby with no brain? What's that worth?
We're approaching the end of our time together, Helen. Is there anything else that you want to get out to our listeners?
Yeah, I think go to my website, helencaldicott.com, and read the books that I've written and learn. As Jefferson said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion, particularly if you're a mother and a father who loves their children. That's what you must do. And then you must decide what you're going to do about it and become John's or Joan of Arc. Get on your white steed and change the whole policy in Canada. I have a little hope for Justin Trudeau. I met with Pierre, his father, and convinced him to start the Five Continent Six Nation Peace Initiative. And I'm hoping that Justin will be similar to his wonderful father. But who knows? We'll have to wait and see. But you can change. You do live in a democracy, which means you take responsibility for your country and for your children.
Be sure to check out the latest book edited by Helen Caldicott, Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe. You can find more links to stories we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Helen, thank you so much for talking with us again today.
It's my extreme pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. My conclusion? Any more money spent on nuclear power is a waste of the dwindling fuel, resources, and carbon space in the atmosphere. Humans will have to be very fortunate to care for existing plants over dozens of generations. Given our history, our failed economics, and the magnitude of climate disruption developing, some reactors somewhere will blow out, slowly or in concert. I hope I am not one of the unlucky evacuees if the radioactive tanks blow up at Hanford and Washington State. I hope none of you is predestined to abandon a whole region of your country with all the beloved spaces, experiences, and resources lost to humans. Accepting that risk is a betrayal of nature, a betrayal of whatever or whoever initiated this possibility of everlasting evolution of life here in space. That's what I think. That's what I feel. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock again this week.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.